everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. We've got the full crew here once again. I think it's the first time in a month. Joining me, we've got Josh Torres.
Alarmo.
We have Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
Welcome back from Tokyo. No, he was back last week, but we have James.
Hey.
And joining us again, we have Adam Vitale.
Happy Thanksgiving, Chow.
Oh, yeah, it is Thanksgiving.
Holy shit. Damn. That's an insane call out.
Yes. So that is the Canadian Thanksgiving, in case anyone else is confused. But yeah, everyone's back from their work trips, from their family trips, from their vacations. So we're recording this on, you know, in the middle of October, and we have been looking forward to this podcast for a while. Anyone who's listening to this, looking at our thumbnail, it's very clear what we're going to be talking about. And that, of course, is the release of Atlus's new IP, Metaphor ReFantazio. So you, obviously, if you're reading, listening to this podcast, our review is already posted. You've likely already seen the critical reception. Things seem to be really well received. A lot of excitement, a lot of hype around this game. And we've got two people on staff that have played through it. I especially want to shout out Josh here, who has, for the last couple weeks, been diligently working his ass off with the review for Metaphor, for getting guide pages ready, kind of working with all the other contributors who also had code to talk about how we want to cover this. And it's just been a lot behind the scenes. So thank you so much, Josh, for all your effort with all the kind of the administrative delegating that you've done with this game.
Yeah, it was a really, really big project for the site. So just wanted to make sure we did it right.
All right, so we're just going to, I think, leap right into that. This podcast is mostly going to be kind of the inverse of last, where not a lot of news to talk about, but we have a good number of games coming out, basically from this point to the end of the year. So I'll stop repeating that. But we're going to go head first into Metaphor. We have, of course, Josh's coverage of it. We'll talk about his review, critical reception, thoughts, you know, new for Atlus, you know, familiar from Atlus. And then, of course, James has also played it. And we've got other people who've played the demo or who have started the game because it's obviously released a few days ago at the time of recording. So, Josh, Metaphor ReFantazio. There's lots of places you could decide to kick off your discussion here. Obviously, the biggest thing is that it's a new IP. It's kind of a new thing for Atlus. It's not tethered to anything of their existing IPs or existing projects. So what does that entail when you dive into this game?
Yeah, it was a really interesting thing to just kind of see when it got re-unveiled at like that Xbox showcase that was 1 or 2 years ago, like because this was initially concepted as Project ReFantazio like nearly a decade ago, right? So, and then we had like that string of years like, well, what's going on with Project ReFantazio and whatnot? And then we finally got to see its current evolution into Metaphor ReFantazio from that showcase from Xbox. So it's really an interesting project because it is a brand new IP, but it's also like a culmination of like everything Atlus has done, like pretty much like you've heard it all around like the internet and seeing that like this game is sort of like a greatest hits game from Atlus, but it's not tethered to any series. So like if people felt like, you know, they didn't want like the baggage of like Persona or Shin Megami Tensei or Etrian Odyssey or anything like that, they just want to see, hey, like, what is Atlus capable of? I just like want an RPG that's kind of like not tied to anything. Like, Metaphor is like a great RPG in that sense of like, hey, this is kind of a game from Atlus that distinctly feels like it's from Atlus. It's definitely their style, kind of all mixed together. You kind of have the Persona calendar system with the SMT press turn system, a little bit of Etrian Odyssey influence with the archetype job classes work and the formations in battle with the front row and back row, and sort of adopting some of their more old school dungeon crawling philosophy and so forth. So it is definitely feels like a greatest hit to that aspect where you can kind of pull systems from other previous Atlus games into like forming this game, but overall like taken from the bones of other Atlus games and then creating like a whole brand new world and cast and story from it. It's just like it feels like a very, very, very solid RPG overall. It feels very gratifying. It feels like a return to like that classic traditional fantasy sort of setting, medieval fantasy, you know, dragons, knights in armor, castles, and also you have that sense of a journey. And I think that's really something that really makes it stand out from a lot of Atlas RPGs, where it feels like it has a good, great sense of, like, you know, traveling from place to place and, like, kind of thinking about what you're going to do on the road as you're traveling from place to place. Because even though you're confined by this calendar system, you have to start thinking about, okay, like, there's in-game days that pass by whenever I do something. The game will convey, hey, if you do this activity, you go into the next section of this day, or you'll wrap up this day if you choose to do it. And that even applies to, like, when you're on the road under this big gauntlet runner vehicle that, like, travels across the land. You also have to think within, like, what am I going to do on this vehicle these days? So you, like, you just have that sense of, like, you're on the road. What am I going to do until I get to my destination, sort of thing. And it's kind of like a nice system shakeup from Atlas. I just really liked the sense of, like, exploration in this game and going from, like, a new town, a new city, and seeing, like, just a brand new environment and locale there.
Yeah, so when this game was first, like, revealed, not as the teaser, but as Metaphor Reventazio, it was pretty easy at the time to just take a look at that, like, debut trailer and just kind of label it as, oh, this is just fantasy Persona. Because it showed, like, the social links and things like that and the social stats or, you know, equivalents of that. But it seems like from your review, from what you're saying now, and of course the impressions of other people, that sure, there is some Persona influence, obviously, but it's more than just that. And I remember even the director said, Hashino said, that journey element, that kind of world exploration element that you were just talking about, is a key component that he considers, like, what makes it stand apart. And there are other components as well that you touched on, like the class systems and, you know, some of the battle stuff and whatnot being drawn from other IP from Atlas, more like Shin Megami Tensei or even Etrian Odyssey. So I haven't played the game yet, but that's cool to me that it's not just fantasy Persona. It's Persona really component tied in with a bunch of other things.
Yeah, me and you were thinking about this. Like, we really hope this isn't just fantasy Persona when it's first unveiled, even though, like, they made it seem like that. But I'm really glad that it's more than that. It just feels really fresh, you know. That's really appreciated from it. James, I'm curious to hear from you also, just kind of like your first impressions of this game and, like, what were your expectations going in and how did that evolve over time?
Honestly, I didn't know what to expect heading in. Like, obviously, from, like we said, from the outside looking in, you could tell that it had a lot of Persona DNA. And obviously, I was in a situation where sitting down to play the full game, I had a better idea of what to expect than anyone else because I went to the preview event. So I got a bit of a taste of what the gameplay loop was going to be. So I guess I knew from that point, okay, here's what the overall gameplay loop is going to be, but how is the full picture going to come together? How am I going to like the entire, like, kind of package, as it were? And I think it's really good. I love a good job system in my RPGs, and I think that Metaphor is, like, up there as one of the best, like, job systems in RPGs now, which feels very good to say.
Yeah, it's a really interesting, like, versatile job system because, like, you know, how similar to Persona, how there's, like, social links in this game, you have followers, right? And then Persona with the social links, when you go invest in a social link, there's a tarot card system, and then you have the different, you know, tarot card categories like the Fool, the World, the Magician, the Priestess, and so forth. While in this game, those social link equivalents in Metaphor through the followers, instead of representing like a tarot card category, they represent a different archetype job class. So the more time you invest in a certain person, the more you expand the options of that certain job class. Like Maria, for example, she represents the healer job archetype. So by spending more time with her, you can unlock like new job classes underneath like that healer lineage tree. So you'll have more advanced classes underneath that healing role. You'll have more skill inheritance slots as you level her up to like bring skills from other job archetypes into like the healing role. So you can like kind of start making almost like a custom class of your own. Say like you're healer focused, but then you have options to cast different elemental healing or elemental offensive spells from like the mage or the wizard, for example. Or you can like if you want to go for like a tank role, but they have the ability to cast magic even though they're a tank. You know, they can like cast a spell to like get aggro, and then they can also fire off magic spells should you choose. And then it gets into like more specialty roles, like commander, for example, which is a personal favorite of mine in the game, where the commander role has special skills that, you know, adjust the front row and back row alignments of all your party at once through a single skill while giving them buffs at the same time, or you know, and also being able to, like, you know, take out a full defensive stance because everyone in the back row means that they all take less damage from incoming melee attacks. So being able to do that just on the fly with buffs through the commander class is like a really cool thing. And then you can expand that role to like incorporating other skills from other jobs into that role as well. So it's like, it feels like a genuinely, like, there's a great gameplay incentive with the follower support system to, you know, continually invest in that. And then in order to like advance some of them, you need to like advance your social stat royal virtues, like in Persona. So it creates this interesting dynamic in chemistry where you're incentivized to push up these stats, to go meet new people and deepen your relationship with them. And through that, you are powering yourself up with gameplay options through genuinely, you know, pretty tough dungeons and encounters. Like, I was also surprised with this game that, like, it has a bite to this game. Like, usually in past, like, recent Atlas entries, like, you know, the easy one to turn to is, like, Persona 5 Royal's, like, hardest difficulty being, like, pretty easy. Or, like, even Persona 3 Reload's, like, harder difficulties not really being that all that difficult because of how much they kind of, you know, power up the player in those games. Like, this one, like, if you start off on hard difficulty, like, you are going to get your ass kicked multiple times. And that's not a bad thing, you know? Like, it actually incentivizes you to really think about the enemy composition, what their strengths and weaknesses are, their resistances, and how do you manipulate your party so you have, like, a proper archetype setup through them and a good turn order to really get your economy rolling in battle against them. And there's a really nice tension in that, especially the first, like, 30 hours of the game, and you're really trying to come to grips about, like, expanding your options and thinking about how you're going to navigate around some enemies and dungeons. Because sometimes you don't want to take encounters in dungeons because you're limited on resources. So sometimes it's just like the play is, hey, I don't want to fight this thing. Let me go stun it and then keep on running and moving forward, making progress in that.
So I have not played the full release, but I did play the generous demo, which I know doesn't put me on, like, even footing to say anything too enlightening, but I'm probably one of, like, four people that has not played Persona 5. So my comparisons when I talk about my, you know, my Atlas experience are Shin Megami Tensei 5, of course, for, like, the press turn system, and then Persona 4 is the last Persona game I've played. So that's kind of, like, my point of reference. And it's just cool to see, like, familiar systems integrated in a different way. In the demo, like, one just early easy example of this is that I was fighting that optional dragon boss, and it's in the demo, so I'm not going to call it a spoiler, and it's not a story boss. And I was kind of struggling with it because I was deciding deliberately not to use mages, because I'm like, I don't want to use a mage. But in that early in the game, that's really the only way you're going to be able to exploit its weakness. So I actually, like, decided to reconfigure my team at the limited amount of party members and archetypes I have available to me at the time, and basically turn that fight into a piece of cake, a cakewalk. And that's just a really early example. And I'm trying to, like, I just, obviously at the end of the demo, you get Hulkenberg, you get access to her starting class, which is the knight. And, like, I was kind of struggling to figure out how to get the knight to, like, mesh well, because I'm very offensively minded normally. I normally build, like, my parties or my characters in single player games as, like, glass cannons. The best defense is a good offense. So I was trying to figure out how to get the knight to work, and I couldn't quite within the confines of the demo, but just hearing all the things about what I've seen in the guide work that's gone on, and of course with the full release of the game, try to look at other archetypes, and just I'm interested to kind of tinker and see how different combinations work, and figure out what compositions, like, suit my playstyle. Because in Persona 4, I don't remember having to, because it's very different, because you just have, you know, the wild card persona and then your party members. And I think you get Yosuke, Chie, and Yukiko early. And like, I just kind of use them throughout most of the game. And you're not really incentivized, at least on a normal playthrough, to kind of experiment a lot. Where already in Metaphor, even early on, it seems like you really are incentivized. And I'm sure like Persona 4 obviously is a bit dated at this point. But maybe Persona 5 also did that. I just don't have that point of reference.
Yeah, I mean, it's very like, you know, it's very common for people to like get the four starting party members in Persona 5 have that be their final party as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, like it's totally viable in Metaphor 2 if you want to go that route. But obviously, you know, they're the later party members. You know, they have their not unique job classes, because you can unlock that for anyone else to use eventually. But obviously, everyone has their own stat lines that like you don't have any influence on like how they develop their stat lines, only your main character. So some of them may be more better suited for like a magical class, some of them may be suited for a more physical class, sort of the nature of the beast in that regard.
That's kind of why I didn't use mages, because the two characters you have early on, I'm like, neither of these seem appropriate for a mage, and I don't want to have the MC be a mage, so I'm not going to use a mage. And then I'm like, no, wait, I really, really should for this boss. And it was far easier to actually like not be stubborn, I guess. So I'm interested in just kind of pulling at that thread.
Yeah.
In all the different instances that it appears.
Yeah, I really appreciate the one thing that I think the one thing that Metaphor's job system does that really elevates it for me is that it feels like so many other drop systems, it's like you have to really commit to a specific like build you want to do, which that's fine for specific games. But I appreciate that Metaphor has a thing where once you master an archetype, if you put like 1,000 archetype experience into it, you get an item that you can use to give any other archetype 1,000 experience. So it doesn't actively punish you for using a job that's already, well, an archetype that's already been mastered. So it kind of is like, okay, well, just use whatever makes sense in the current moment.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a really like smart design decision that they implemented, where like you don't have to bring like like other RPG the job systems, right? We've all had this feeling where, you know, they mastered like, you know, their starting class and like maybe another class, and it's like, okay, those are maxed, and then I'd lock this new job and it starts at level 1. But then this class looks like it has really good skills, so I want to put that person on this job class that's level 1 to start leveling them up, you know. And then once they're done mastering that class, it's like, okay, time to go on another job class that's level 1, so they start leveling that up. While this game, it's like you can stick with whatever party composition and archetype composition that you want and that you desire, and like you're getting refunded the experience that you put into over leveling those master classes. So, and then those consumable items, like James said, can be used on anyone, on any archetype. Like it's just basically, hey, here's the free experience that you grinded up, and you can use it on anyone else.
Yeah, I think we've all played job system games where it's like, man, a ninja would be super useful against this boss, but I've already maxed ninja, so I don't want to play as a ninja because then they won't get anything. I'm going to instead have them play as the clown, which is a much worse class.
Or you get base world because you're not using the right job class or it's underleveled.
So,
Not quite the same thing, but also like when your job class influences your stat ups, it's like, don't level anything until you get the sage, because that's how you max your magic. And you have to, and you're like incentivized to play in very like weird manufactured ways to try to be like as efficient as possible. Where here it's like, if your class isn't maxed, your archetype isn't maxed, you're going to get AXP for it. If it is maxed, you're not losing that opportunity cost, because we're still going to give you AXP that you can use not just on any class, but correct me if I'm wrong, on any character. So
yeah,
it's even flexible to that degree.
Yeah,
like that's a really fun implementation of that idea. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to think, was there like a class that you would use in Bravely Default or something like that, where the class is so shitty, but you just want it for like the passive skill so you could bring it to a different class? Is there something like that in this game? You just want to use the archetype?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely archetypes where like it may not measure like how you like to play, but there's like a specific passive skill that earns like at rank 13, for example. It's like maybe it has like a passive skill that's like increases slash attack damage by 20%. You're like, well, I really want that for my character, right? So you can just like You know, either you could either go the manual way of like equipping that class and leveling it up, or if you have like consumables, just use consumables to level up that class to rank 13, and then, you know, and then basically get that skill that you want and then inherit it into another class that you're using. So it's like, okay, yoink, that's my I can use that now for my current setup, you know. And all that consume is like this magla resource that's like pretty easily like obtained, like, you know, through battles and like in dialogue choices, you know. It's not like the magla resource isn't like something that you're actively being drained on, unless you're like trying to lock every single job for every single character every single time it's like immediately unlocked, which is like, you know, you're gonna find out earlier on that's like, that's probably not the way to go. Just unlock classes as I need them, not necessarily that I have to unlock them every single time for every single character. You know, just take what you need. So it's yeah, like,
even if you do literally everything in this game, you're not gonna, realistically, the game doesn't expect you to max out every archetype on every character. It wants you to, while you can give pretty much every character any archetype you want, there are absolutely specific archetypes that the game expects you to use for specific characters because of the way that their stat spreads work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, you know, and you don't have to be confined to that, but it's like, it's just like, if you want to, make use of their strongest stat, you know, obviously there's some jobs that are more suited for that role. So it's what's, it'll make more sense once you once you progress more through the game. It's like, okay, that's, you know, it's way more flexible and more free than like what you may be thinking in your mind. Like it's definitely one of those games that, like, it tries to kind of shake you out of like traditional RPG mindset of like, don't feel like you're getting you're feeling restricted over like how this job's class system works. It's way more flexible than what you're probably thinking. Because you've been conditioned by other past RPGs to be like, oh man, I have to like optimize the way I like, you know, hopping from job to job to job and getting maximum like gains if I decide to like level up these jobs or invest in these jobs in a certain order. It's like, this game definitely wants you to shake you out of that. And it's just like, just do what you want and what makes sense for you, you know, enjoy it the way that you want to, and it won't punish you for that. There's even like really like, you know, like goofy jobs, like, you know, like you can go like a luck build and do like the merchant class, for example. And there's certain skills from the merchant that like works really well with a luck build, and also it has some gameplay benefits. Like there are some monsters that like use the merchant skills on, because the merchant basically uses money instead of HP and MP to the fire off its skills. So for certain types of enemies, their tendency might be like, you know, they get distracted by money, so they actually waste turns, like, you know, staring at the money that like you threw at them, pretty much, which is really good because you want them to not take their turn, so you basically get a free turn, like, you know, they waste their turn from it. That can be really vital in surviving, because that enemy might be doing a lot of damage to you, and so forth. And that also links to like another thing in this game that I really like, is like the way it world builds certain gameplay mechanics, like when you get a new side quest or a new dungeon and so forth, there are these informants in taverns in the game that you can actually purchase intel from, and like this intel is actually pretty vital, like understanding what you get a good idea of what you're up against. So very, very early on, one example I really like to put up is like, you purchase this intel about this dungeon with goblins from this informant, and like one of the details that this informant mentions is that, hey, you might want to think twice about going in there with a mace or a staff, because when goblins see that weapon type, they get enraged, and then you're trying to think of like, well, like why do they get enraged when they see it? it's because they've learned over time that like when they see those objects, they have magic incorporated with them or associated with them, so they just like immediately get mad because so many goblins have been slain by like fire magic before or something, so they're just like, they just snap when they see those weapons. So it's like, oh, okay, so I have to start thinking about like going into this dungeon but without like the without relying on like these certain archetypes, because they use these types of weapons, because if I do that, then I'm putting myself at a disadvantage and they're just like, they're just immediately enraged, you know. So it's like little things like that that like you wouldn't know going in unless you purchased intel like that. But the intel is like enough so it doesn't spoil the rest of the dungeons mechanics. But and it's just enough to like kind of give you a heads up of like, okay, here's what you expect.
Even if you don't buy the intel, the game does generally give you multiple avenues to figure that information out before you like fuck around and find out. Like usually there will be like some sort of NPC in that dungeon. It's like, hey, careful.
Yeah. So it's just a really like, it's a great, like, once again, a really good, like just small mechanic in like a role play setting to kind of immerse you in that world even more. That's a really cool thing to just kind of include in there as like a little small thing, a little small detail.
And the, even like in the demo, and you brought this up in your review, and everyone who's played the demo has seen this, just even like they make it in universe, like the music that plays in the character's head is actually just like a magic spell. You know, like they didn't have to do that. And like with the informants, they didn't have to like make it make sense in the universe, but they did. And it just kind of, it kind of makes it all cohesive where it makes sense in the world it's in. It's not just a mechanic, like, you know, in a video game. One thing we haven't talked about yet is just like the story premise. Of course, you know, a lot of the premise is available in the demo. But, and I know we don't want to just, we're not going to go into like deep end game spoilers, but clearly it's a different vibe being a different setting, obviously with a lot of inter-social kind of boundaries in terms of the 8 different races that are present. The fact that the premise of the game involves, you know, political ownership of the throne. So just what are your like general thoughts on just the narrative premise of the game?
You can start, James.
So I'll be honest, with the sort of framing for metaphor from the get-go and some of the same team's histories with like history with writing sensitive subjects and persona, I was definitely a little bit concerned because like obviously metaphor's main thing is you're rallying together to try and become the new king so that the society can move forward beyond like racism and classism and all that sort of things. So from that standpoint, I was very concerned. I wasn't sure how it was going to turn out. Luckily, I feel like, and pretty much everyone else that's played it seems to agree that the game managed to stick the landing and actually did a pretty decent job with it. So, I'm pretty happy with how these stories turned out, especially with regards to, like, the thematics and whatnot.
I did not read the article, mostly because I don't want to really be spoiled, even though I bet they're probably fine. But I did see an article from The Verge that basically said, Metaphor Refantasio goes beyond racism 101, which was also kind of a curiosity I had, because there are plenty of like fantasy games that basically say racism bad, and then they think that's like sufficient to like that's their message, and so it's from what I hear based on like premise articles like that and what I've heard from some impressions, it feels like Metaphor is pretty thoughtful here and more
there's
beyond
substance.
That.
Yeah, there's actual substance to it, and it's clear that the team really did genuinely think about the subject matter and wanted to like showcase the thought that's been put into it in the narrative itself. So.
I'm sorry, this is a little bit of a tangent, but you know what that made me think of? Like one of the old Witcher 3 trailers where, I don't know if you know where I'm going with this, but where they're talking about like, we talk about sensitive subjects, even racism.
Oh, I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, it sort of became a meme. Even racism.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. Yeah. I just thought of that.
Yeah.
But even like even the premise of the story that's available in the demo, where one of the main characters' like points of comfort is this book, this fantasy book in a fantasy game. So you can kind of, I can kind of see like what they're doing with that, where they say like, well, in this utopia, there is no, you know. There is no racism. It's all like, and I'm trying to remember, it's either everyone can use magic or no one can use magic. But it basically is like, it's presented in a way like we're in universe. It's thought of as a utopia. Like, gee, wouldn't that be nice? But to the player, I think it's supposed to come off like unnerving. Like, well, I don't want to erase so everyone is the same race or everyone's the same tribe. That's not utopia. Like, and I'm not making any judgment. Like, I hope the game kind of turns that on its head a little bit, or kind of shows how that sort of thought process in the wrong person's hands or in the wrong person's mind can be corrupted to belie the intent, so to speak. It's intriguing enough of a hook there, even within the demo. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll say that exactly what you just said there, you will be happy with the way this game turns out.
Gotcha.
You'll be happy.
Because I'm blanking on her name because I just blitzed a demo in one session. The fairy, your
sister. Galica, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Galica. She's like, yeah, wouldn't that be nice, you know, where even fairies could be equal to everyone else. And it's just kind of like, well, like, equal, sure. But like the way it was presented, I think it's supposed to put the player kind of on edge. And definitely got that across to me where I'm like, I don't think that's a utopia, guys. Like, so I'm excited to hear that the game does address that. And I think it's really well set up, and like not only just like the gameplay elements being active early in the demo, but like giving you that narrative story hook, motivation to keep playing further.
Yeah, it's interesting how Metaphor handles a lot of this, right? Because like, as James mentioned, there's a lot of I guess for people who know Atlas, like, you know, and is more familiar with their staff members, you know, like when they heard that Hashino was directing this, and, you know, due to some certain scenes like in Persona 5 during the beach scene in the vanilla Persona 5, with the two, you know, more eccentric characters going up to your party, and then also how Kanji was handled in Persona 4, you know, there's definitely a history with Atlas in that regard of like kind of doing some more of these aspects of society, like kind of the dirty. So like seeing them kind of strain the record in a sense with Metaphor, like trying to be more thoughtful about this, seeing like, you know, society is no longer like, you know, we progressed past such certain things of like being able to like, it's less acceptable. It should have never been acceptable to treat these, you know, like, you know, people who are gay, trans, lesbian, binary, non-binary, etc. You know, treating them less. It should have never been acceptable to treat them less before, but even more so now that, like, you know, we've progressed past that, we're making an active effort, you know, to, you know, have equality and equity, you know, for everyone, and not feel left out, and just because of the way they are and how they identify, and so, sort of stuff. So trying to incorporate and, you know, be more thoughtful about those elements and metaphors and interesting sort of like evolution for that studio, especially on the writing team on this end, for Metaphor to kind of directly more address those aspects in a more, James mentioned, a more nuanced manner. And it does a pretty great job, because it's all framed in this, like, you know, as the premise of the game shows, you know, you're on this election toward to become king and trying to gather supporters. So you're seeing not just your followers, but other characters in the story and other candidates in the story. It's a very, 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 very diverse selection of like people from different age groups, people from different backgrounds, people from different social positions, people who are different on the social ladder, like seeing their perspectives and views of where they're coming from, and like how this has shaped their life in a world, in a fantasy world, where like the discrimination and looking down on other people different from you is the norm in this world, you know. And it's pretty much like widely accepted too, you know. So see, I try to make sense of that, like from this main character who already from the get-go, because of their life, you know, his previous life experiences, you know, already feels like that, like, people should be equal, because I'm from this elder tribe, and like I've seen the atrocities that, like, you know, that this world has, you know, done for my tribe before. You know, I kind of wish that like people didn't have to suffer like that. And trying to understand that from other people who have been wronged in other different ways, as you get to know them more, and bundling that up with like, since you're on an election to become king, it's like, what makes the ideal ruler? How does a ruler, you know, come to grips with this? How does a ruler try to, you know, not necessarily blanketly fix society, but like try to take steps towards like making a better tomorrow, you know? I think it's very good and thoughtful of the game to paint this picture that like change doesn't come overnight, change doesn't come instantaneously, change doesn't come easy. it's a very grueling, long process that, like, you have to really develop a certain mentality and characteristic for, and it's hard, and you won't get there just by, like, staying enclosed. You have to go out and meet new people and interact with them and come to truly know them, you know? And I think that's a really, really interestingly well-done part of the game, you know, in that respect. So it's such a, like, an interesting framework, too, because, like, the people who not only you meet as followers, but also the people who come to join your party, you know, they all come from different tribes, you know? And seeing that sort of, like, okay, how do these people come together, even though they're all so different? And can they find a common ground, a common goal to work against? And throughout that journey of striving towards this common goal, can they come to understand each other and, like, you know, genuinely see each other as, like, allies, as people that you can trust to have your back and form that relationship, that bond with? Which is, you know, it's a pretty, pretty interesting, like a lot of interesting concepts that they're dealing with. That's, like, it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Are any of the party members, like, do they, I'm trying to word this, like, specifically, are any of the party members, when you initially meet them, standoffish in that way, or not?
Yes.
Quite, like, they're okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's definitely party members where, one thing that actually I want to say really quick that I feel like Metaphor does really, really, really well compared to previous, like, I'm just gonna say Persona 5.
Yeah.
Compared to Persona 5, there's some characters that join very, very late. One in particular I'm thinking of, where, thank God, they interact with the party early on, and you can see them gradually, like, open up to you. So when they do finally join the party, it feels, like, earned, and you don't even feel like.
Yeah, it's definitely able to, like, because, you know, there's definitely been past Atlas RPGs and just RPG in general, where you get that final. There's a term for it, but it's basically the final party member syndrome, where it feels like this final party member that you got joined way too late, and you barely know them. You know, they're really cool, but it just feels like they're kind of way too late into the picture.
And while thankfully, that's not a problem in this one. If anything, they're probably one of the characters you know the best.
Yeah. So sorry for cutting you off, Brian. You had a thought going.
Well, my thought was just, like, it is very tricky in any game to have someone be an ally to the protagonist, but they're not a good person or a perfect person. Like, and there's a couple examples here.
Brian, I want to see if I can read your mind. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite party member dynamics in a game is actually Waka and Riku in Final Fantasy X.
That's not a specific one I was thinking of, but that is a good one. Because it's very easy, if you have a person who is flawed, to also make that person very unlikable. And in some cases, you are supposed to not like them for that sense. But the example there I was thinking of was, like, Ashley from Mass Effect. She is very, like, I forget what they call it in universe, but, like, humanistic in that sense. And she kind of gets better, but not in a way that's convincing, or not in a way that anyone's, like, in her corner. And so she's, by the time all said and done, is not a very popular character. And I was just thinking of, actually, Rogue Trader that I just played. That whole universe is mired in people being very, like, xenophobic. They literally call the alien Xenos. And then you get Xenos in your party, and it's like, you have to get along for this common goal. I'm thinking of the character Earliet, who is a Xenos, like, sniper, who is very distrustful of humans. Your human, like, crusaders are very distrustful of her. Like, you even have the option just to execute her because she's not a human. Like, but, like, you can kind of navigate through that. And by the end of it, it's not all, you don't want to, like, go too far the other direction. Like, oh, but then I completed the game story and everything was kumbaya because I fixed everything in short order. It was that easy. It's like, well, no, it's not that either. That's why I say it's tricky, because you want to see, like, You want the misunderstanding or the preconceptions to be believable and realistic. This is what these people grew up in. In their universe, this race has always been lesser. That's the way it is. But then you also just want to see, like, the positive momentum. Like, due to the efforts of the player or the protagonist, you can see momentum moving, and you might not get there, but you can kind of make that progress. And it's got to be believable, too, because if any one of those things, it's not believable, or you're not in their court, or there's nothing sympathetic about them, you just end up hating the character.
It's extremely tough to do, for sure. Yeah.
Well, in my example, you know, like, Waka is not a very popular character, but he's not necessarily a great person, at least not initially, but I think he's a very useful character in that world. It's not a main focus of the game, but it is a component of that world where the Albed are discriminated against. And there's also a religion tie into that. And I think Waka and Riku basically are kind of like your proxy into that prejudice that you see. And by the end of the game, those two characters actually do kind of, you know, they kind of warm up to each other by the end. But as Brian says, it isn't just all like by the end of the game, oh, dust your hands off, everything's happy and good now. But I do think, you know, like Brian has been saying, it's kind of a useful mechanism to basically
and
portray that and have characters that like, kind of fill that purpose.
And I don't want the end of metaphor to be spoiled for me, but like I hope it's not. And then you became king and all the tribes lived in harmony.
I won't spoil it, but I was definitely surprised at the way that how they presented the finale of the game, like sort of like almost the epilogue of the game almost. And I don't know like if James will catch on to what I'm talking about here, but like you really get to see how like, you know, I'm not going to say that like that's whether that's how it ends or not, but it's definitely interesting to see how like these relationships have evolved and flourished in that epilogue. I'll just keep it at that. I won't say how the game ends or like how or allude to like whether you're right or wrong, you know. But I was definitely taken. It caught me off guard. Let's say, and I was like, oh, that's really cool that they did this. They showed this.
I'm just more concerned if they did something like a Persona 5. It's like, here, have to do this like 30-hour like extended like epilogue, and then you have to like go through all the shit, and it just kind of like ruins the flow of the game. I just hope it doesn't pull that card.
You're gonna have to find out.
Yeah,
you have to find out. So you know, but yeah, I mean, it's just I don't want to like spoil like you know like who joins you in the party or anything. I just really. I think once everything comes together and you get like your cast of characters, it's like, oh, it's really cool that like this is how it came together. There's really something like there's like a certain, you know, like in Persona, like, you know, they awaken to their archetypes throughout this game. You know, so when you first get like your magic power, you know, like in the demo, for example, you have like this whole thing of like this mysterious light, this woman talking to you about getting. Basically, what's like your job class in the game, and you get like these sick avatars to represent them. So yeah, they sort of have their own persona awakening moment. I won't spoil anything once again, but like the final party members awakening like really caught me off guard. Like oh, that's really cool that they did it at this time like this, and I'm like, whoa, that really was a cool moment.
It's gonna suck that we can't talk inevitably can't talk about the final party member until like. 3 or 4 weeks from now, because it's like I love them so fucking much, man. They're so good. I guess I'll just say it. It's gonna be really tough for me to reconcile whether or not I'm gonna be fighting for this or Rebirth to be my RPG of the year, because it's tough. It's real tough.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes down. You know, something we didn't really touch upon here, but you know, going to metaphor, when they showed off the gameplay of it, finally we saw the like, hey, this looks kind of familiar. They're kind of going for the like the Trails into Daybreak approach of like you have this action phase that you can transition to a turn-based phase. You know, you could go turn-based right away, but obviously the intended method is to go up to an enemy and like hit them a few times to get them stunned. So, like, when you go into turn-based mode, they're, like, in a stunned phase. So, like, you sort of have some free turns. If they get turns while they're stunned, it'll skip over them. So, James, I'm gonna go to you first on this, because, you know, both you and I and other people here have played Trails into Daybreak. And, you know, and we've also, like, seen, like, the later evolutions of how Falcom has done this action real time into turn-based sequence. How did you feel about Atlas's first go at it, let's say, on this action turn-based battle mode?
Okay, so I will say this. I feel like the actual action combat and metaphor probably feels a little bit better than the same like idea in Daybreak. And I'm saying that especially because I went back to back. I've been finishing up like Kuro 2 right after I fucking finished Metaphor. So I have the direct comparison here. I think the overall system, the way that Daybreak handles it is better because it's a like smooth transition on the field. And I like the way that works a lot better, especially since you have to consider where you're positioning like enemies on the field before you transition into the combat and whatnot, which is something you just don't have to worry about in like Metaphor. You just, as soon as you get up the stun meter, it's like immediately go into a turn-based combat. There's no reason to just not. So
unless you want to run past them, you know, you can just stun them and run past them.
Yeah.
But the Falcons benefit, like they also had like expertise on like working on East games, right? So it's like, okay, we know how to make it, we know how to make this feel smooth, like on the field. While, you know, Atlas has never really done an action RPG or like action game, sort of, so to speak. So it definitely feels stiff in Metaphor. Like if you're used to, like, it was funny because seeing like, you know, friends of mine who like are used to Daybreak 2 and Kai, go into Metaphor and they're just like, fuck, man, the action portion deals, like, it feels like really bad to them because they're so used to how Falcom did it in those games, especially with Kai, because Kai feels like very, very free flowing.
As anyone who's only played Daybreak 1, it felt mostly like comparable to me, but I haven't played the refinement with 2 or Kai.
Yeah.
One thing I do like that Metaphor does is that how like your like action combat is dependent on your archetype, and specific archetypes feel really broken for action combat. Like I'm especially like the later Seeker archetypes. It's like, man, those are fucked up. Like,
So, because like when your main character changes job class, like each job like lineage category has different weapons. So their weapons, like on the fly, on in action mode, will change. So, like if they're on knight archetype, for example, they'll have the spear out in the field instead of the sword and seeker.
Well, even beyond that, like even like elite archetypes will have like different, like slightly different attacks. Like,
And they have like that hero passive as well, that has like different bonuses that can like give you, like say, like if you stun or defeat an enemy in action combat. Like one of the hero passes could be like, oh, it gives you MP or it gives you HP for that. Or one of them, like, it's easier to stun enemies with this one. So, you know, it brings to some, like, you know, along with like the move set, it also gives you like different, like small passive bonuses that you can have out there in action, which is, you know, I think it's an okay first go at it. There's definitely a lot of refinement they can make if they choose to make another Metaphor game with sort of this sort of hybrid system.
But it feels like it's inevitable with how well it's been received and how it's been selling already so far.
Yeah, how many hours till the 1 million landmark?
It was like 7 or 8. It's like, and I've seen some people saying that Atlas is like overshipped this year. Well, Sega Atlas is overshipped this year, but even just going by the Steam charts, it's like, no, this is like, I guess the question now isn't how quickly did it sell 1 million, but more like how quickly until it sells 5, because that's inevitable at this point.
Yeah, I'm really wondering to see how far this will go. Like, it's just been really like that. Like, even if we're going by Steam charts, like this has had like, this is the single best performing Atlas game ever on Steam, just based on like a current 24 hour numbers on there. Just, you know, it was interesting to see, like, okay, there's a brand new IP. Does it have the Persona backing IP to really, you know, it doesn't have that recognition by the broad audience. But that seems like if anything, it's kind of like worked to its benefit. That's a brand new thing now. And it's like, okay, that people are just like, a lot more people are giving it a shot. And I think the single best thing that like Sega Atlas did for this game is releasing that really, really chunky demo throughout all platforms and giving that same data transfer progress. And just like, it's basically like, hey, try out the first 6 hours of this game, and if you like it, all that progress that you made in those 6 hours, you can bring it on over.
Shareware is back. Really... It's, this is going to sound maybe a little bit weird, but I guess for some inside baseball, I knew that Metaphor was going to be good even before I started playing it. The moment they sent code in, and it was like 4 weeks before embargo, and the embargo lifted like 4 or 5 days before the game itself came out. Because it's one of those things where it's like, those two things alone just tells you, okay, they're confident. Usually there's a good reason for that. So
yeah.
Early code and early embargo is directly proportional to confidence, which is proportional usually with, you know, the end result. Not in every case, but in most cases.
It was a similar situation with Rebirth, I believe. So
it's really worth mentioning that I got Reynatis code like 3 weeks ahead of embargo.
Let's go.
Embargo. One week ahead of launch.
They were just very confident.
It's only 3 weeks. It wasn't 4 weeks.
Oh, okay.
That extra week matters.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's cool to see, like, you know, it seems like the overall reception so far from people who both reviewed it, but both people who are playing it, just seems to be like, you know, pretty positive. And you know, and Atlas has expressed before that they hope Metaphor will be like a third pillar compared to like a standing alongside Persona, Shin Megami Tensei. And you know, based on like the initial performance of this game, it seems like, hey, you wanted your third pillar, you got it. It sure wasn't Soul Hackers 2, but you know, here we are.
Like, was it a million copies in day one?
Yeah.
So Square Enix should start multi-platform immediately instead of the exclusive crap.
Well, Atlas, not that long ago, was kind of was a PC holdout. Like, how long ago was Persona 4 the first one that was on PC?
Yeah, that was a landmark.
Wasn't Catherine the first one that was on
PC? But in terms of, like, Persona RPG is, well-known. Like, it was Persona 4 Golden. Like, I remember, I think it was you, Adam, who got the email. And it's like, what the fuck's going on? What are they doing?
2020 for Persona 4 Golden on PC.
Yeah, they're bringing Persona PC. What the hell?
And now it's like Atlas is, or Metaphor is, what, like 80,000 concurrent or something like that?
Man, all I'm saying, and I don't want to be like those guys that really hampers on it, but if I was an investor at Square Enix, I would be looking at them like staring at them being like, what the fuck are you doing?
No, I don't want to look up. What was Final Fantasy 16's Steam concurrent?
26,000.
26
or 27 or something. Yeah.
It's not bad, but it's like I wonder like what it could have been.
Yeah, I don't want to like I don't want to get to the weeds of like try to compare them side by side, because like, you know, that's definitely, once again, the PC version is the late port for 16, and also, you know, people bring up that like, hey, the FF16, well, you know, they hit the 3 million sales landmark by like I think half a week or something like that. So people will basically like, you know, get into the game of like, well, no, my RPG did better than yours. Like, no, my RPG did better than yours. And it's gonna compile on top of each other until like, you know, you burn each other out pretty much, you know. So I just want to celebrate on like you know, on its own merits and like and based on the past of like their Atlas's previous titles, right? I'm not trying to compare this to like,
yeah, like I'm not trying to do that, but I'm just saying like I think for Square Enix side of things, like, oh, maybe we should just go for a multi-platform from now on, no exclusive.
I mean, that's the thing that they've already like stated like earlier this year, that fiscal report, right? The restructuring. It's like they're definitely gonna like start looking into that, and you know, I think they've had years and years of like just like looking at like sales performance in general of like, hey, this is the strategy to go forward. So I mean, it's a slow progress to move over, but it seems like they're eventually adopting that business strategy moving forward, or hopefully more so, you know, past this year. And so it's just, we'll see, you know, people are trying their best.
I think the only thing we really didn't talk about too much, it's not like a landmark of the game, but I hadn't played an Atlas game really with, this is going to sound dumb because I haven't played Etrian Odyssey, but when I had played only Persona 4, only Soul Hackers 2, and like Shin Megami Tensei 5, none of those really have anything like great dungeon design. It's passable in Soul Hackers, and Shin Megami Tensei 5, the overworld is fine. So even the demo dungeon in Metaphor felt like a step up to me. But of course, I haven't played like their true dungeon crawlers, either older Shin Megami Tensei or Etrian Odyssey. So I don't know if it's just kind of par for the course, or it's like Atlas Return to Form there.
There's
or
some pretty, there's some pretty creative dungeons in terms of like gimmicks in here. I like for me, like I really like that dungeon and crawler experience from Atlas. I even stated in my reviews, like I kind of wish they kind of were a little bit crueler overall in some of the dungeons that
there's like put for. There's like one specific dungeon that is like so obviously a step above everything else in the game. It's not even the final dungeon, which is wild thing.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so it's but it's definitely like they introduce some variety to it to like just the format of how things shake out. There's like definitely there different quote unquote dungeons. I'll keep it at that, so to speak.
You know what recent-ish game actually had to me like surprisingly good dungeon design in the back half?
I'm hoping I can read your mind here, but go for it.
It's Dragon Quest Monsters: The Dark Prince.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. I was not expecting it. And Cullen actually mentioned this in his review. It's like, wow, like the dungeons in those upper echelon circles are like, when is Dragon Quest had dungeons? Like, these are really
it's
like good.
And I know this is a tangent, so I'm not going to linger on it. But early on, like the first like 20 hours of that game, it's like, you're not going to expect that at all. It's like, this is not what that is. But then later, like you said, like the back third, it's like, here's a series of interconnected rooms with like a pillar you have to rotate that like open and lock off doors and pathways, and you have to do it in a certain order. And it's just like, it's like true like lock and key dungeon design. Like, what the hell? Where did this come
filling
from?
Filling up canals to access different platforms through bridges.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. I wanted to give that shout out because I know I finished that like 2 weeks ago, and I think Adam finished it like this last week. And
Nice. Yeah. So definitely, like, you have your staple dungeon gimmicks and mechanics here as well. There's also like smaller side quest dungeons. So there's definitely like some new dungeons that open up from side quests, and definitely some that like even open up if you purchase intel from an informant. It's like, hey, you have to go here. It's located here, and so forth. And like my only qualm with these is like the internal layouts for them and how they're like actually structured is like interesting to like kind of map out, because some of them are like more reliant on like lots of ladders and a lot of like small secret passages, like for some of them. So they definitely have some sort of like, some of them have like gimmicks in the way that they're structured and what mechanic they're using, but the overall environment gets repetitive, like I stated in my review. So like, you know, you unlock like three new dungeons throughout the course of the game, like side quest dungeons, and they may all have the same jungle environment. And then there's like another like four side quest dungeons, and they all have like the same like tower spire sort of environment to them. So like they're less visually distinct and more like recycled environments wise, like, you know, than the more obviously than the main story dungeons that all have like are all very unique and all very complex and structured and layered in that respect. So that's kind of like one of those things, like, you know, it's Metaphor's already juggling a lot with what it's doing, so it's not like something that like I place too much, like, you know, it's not a big issue, but it's like you know, it's obviously there.
I think recycling like some assets, like even recycling is too negative a word, but like reusing assets to like, you know, dot around in different side quests and optional objectives, I'm totally on board with that. That's where, you know, work smarter, not harder sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I think like the only like the big qualm, obviously, that like kind of didn't get that I had with this game that didn't obviously get the 10 out of 10 is like, you know, it's obviously kind of a shame, but because of the troubled development history of this game, and it's still kind of using that vanilla Persona 5 engine and so forth, like the visuals of this game is kind of rough. Like, you have like these very, really beautiful art portraits, and like the menu is great, and like, it's like, oh man, like they're really like, this is really, really great works of art, and like the way that they're presenting these menus and like in the portraits, but because like sort of like the in-game models and some of the environments in this game, it's like, it's pretty rough visually, especially when you're like out on the, when you finally unlock the Gauntlet Runner vehicle, when you go out on the deck as it's like traveling to something, like the surrounding environment, like when you're going over like a grass field, you know, you'll see like trees like 20 to 30 feet in the distance, and they're like unlit, they're like totally highlighted, and just like they're just totally unlit models, and you're just like, man, it's rough.
I saw that exact moment. You streamed it to me. I was like, oh, desert looks empty.
Yeah, and then obviously there's the this game has like trouble, has a lot of aliasing issues if you don't have it like at a high rendering scale, but if you have it at a high rendering scale, it taxes your machine even more. So you'll get like a more inconsistent performance depending on your set up. So it's kind of like a lot of trade-offs. You know, it has, you know, it's really firing on a lot of cylinders, but, you know, the visuals department, the performance department is kind of the big thing that's really holds it back. That's a very, very blatant, you know, issue for overall.
Yeah, like, I think the game looks pretty. It looks fine, but it's just not, it's not the highlight. It's not, it's not.
Yeah. And that's totally
it's
fine.
It's like list, lower on the list. Yeah, it's yeah. It's good.
Yeah.
And I do like the art direction for the UI and the portraits a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If there's any more questions about that, I'd be happy to answer. But I think we've covered like kind of the full extent of it without spoiling anything.
Yeah, we've kind of gotten as much out of this discussion as we can without going too much into where the story goes.
Yeah.
But no, I'm really excited to play this. I purchased it and transferred over my demo progress just earlier this weekend. And trying to fit it in before Romancing Saga Dragon Age and East.
Yeah.
I guess that's how long did it take you to play, you know, Persona 5, especially the Royal Edition? It's a very, very long game. So
that's an interesting question for me and James, right? Because me and James feel pretty unified that this feels like overall less than Persona 5, like in terms of like playtime, yeah. Runtime. Like it took me 75 hours, like by the in-game timer, and I think that took you a little bit less, James.
It took me 64 hours.
Yeah.
And so, it's like, while I didn't technically do a 100% playthrough, like Josh can confirm that my playthrough was like a 99% playthrough.
Yeah, yeah. And I did 100% as much as you can do out of the first playthrough, and I still was able to get under 80 hours, which is still
I feel like I should specify for both of us that we're trail stickos.
Yeah, yeah. We play RPGs
and yeah. It's like, if you're hearing that and you put like 130 hours or something in the Persona 5, you're probably going to hit 100 hours or 90 hours in Metaphor. Just
I don't know how you are with the trails, James, but like how I am with trails, and like, you know, it's kind of, and that's that sort of habit has been, you know, developed over other RPGs. Like when I map a dungeon, I don't necessarily like fight every single enemy in a dungeon. Like, you know, for whenever I'm just like mapping out a dungeon, I'm usually like, if I'm feeling like I'm behind in levels, I'll definitely like take a few battles here and there to kind of get my levels back up to like some sort of parity with the enemies. But most of the time throughout a dungeon, I'm just mapping it out, skipping enemies, and like getting all the treasure, and just playing it more efficiently. And so like I'm not meandering.
Because it's like, well, if I'm going to be doing all the side quests anyways, I'm not going to be underleveled, so I don't need to fight everything unless I feel like I am underleveled.
Yeah, so we got to have like that same mindset of like, okay, we're not like that. That's kind of like the big like caveat to our playthrough, is like we're not fighting every single encounter that we come across.
Yeah.
I hope it's not like the Xenoblade 3 problem where you did the side quest and then you're like level 99 at a level 40 location or something.
No.
I'd say that the level curve is actually pretty well balanced to doing everything. I would even say that the game feels like, it's funny because before launch, some of the things they were saying gave me the impression that you weren't going to be able to do everything in a single playthrough, when the reality is, both Josh and I basically did 100% playthroughs without guides, without any issues.
Skill issue.
I would say like levels are less important than your equipment in this game. When you're talking about stats scaling, and you'll find like most of like your better equipment like in like dungeons, more so than just like buying them outright. So you don't really have to worry about like the character levels. It's more dependent on like, you know, do you have a good equipment layout, and obviously do you have a good archetype party composition layout, because, you know, that'll ultimately determine whether like you'll feel underleveled or not for a fight. It's like, it's more so than your tactical approach and strategy, less so about like raw numbers.
But yeah, and also you have worked a lot on putting up some guides for this page for the Metaphor, including like a day by day guide to your best extent. I know that's probably why your time was a little bit inflated, is because you were just chronicling all the things you were doing and kind of synthesizing all that together. So not only do we have the written review up on the site, rpgsite.net from Josh, but we've been putting up a number of guides, including more like a walkthrough in that case of the day by day progression. for Metaphor.
Yeah, I definitely took inspiration from Chao. Chao did his Persona 3 Reload. I was like, I definitely styled it a lot. So thank you, Chao, and anyone else who worked on that walkthrough for Persona 3 Reload, because a lot of my inspiration for like how to structure that was based on your guide.
Yeah, I was like trying to go for a minimalist. I was like, okay, you don't really care about like the battle tips and stuff. It's like people are like, yeah, but they want to know what's in a day that they could do, right? I think that's like the most important part, right?
Yeah, and that's definitely what my approach as well. So, and I know, like, you know, for there are definitely a handful of people that like they kind of have choice paralysis and they don't like to like play through Persona style games without sort of one of these sort of guides. So I definitely wanted to like make it a priority when I was going in. I was like, okay, I think I'm capable and have the capacity to do this. I didn't know how much work it was going to be before I started, and it sure was a lot of fucking work, but, you know, I was able to, because the code came in so early for us, that's the only reason it was possible at all. It's like, because we got the game a month early, I was like, okay, I think I have enough time to get something out for people on day one that'll be reliable.
Yeah, and I feel like it's also worth mentioning, it's like, you might be listening to this and being like, man, this is an interesting conversation. How the hell did James play this when he was at TGS last month? Well, I finished up the final boss of the game the day before TGS on the Shinkansen back to Tokyo from Kyoto.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, this wasn't just our outlet, but like for several other outlets, like several other outlets, you know, got code for like PlayStation or PC, and then alongside with that, they get like complimentary Xbox codes, whether that outlet had or had Xboxes like around. They just like part of like, I guess, the marketing deal with Microsoft's like, hey, you know, we'll have complimentary Xbox codes, so maybe more people will check out the Xbox version if they have, you know, other systems that have other people on staff that have these systems, you know, to help cover it as well. So that was an interesting thing that.
Yeah, so I did briefly check it out on Xbox. Mm-hmm. I put like 5-6 hours into it. And at the same time, I installed it on the Xbox app on my PC, and it wasn't immediately available there. Like, it installed the Xcube or something, but it was very obviously not the full game. Like, a day or two after I got code, there was a massive update for that. I was like, okay, I think that's the full game. Let me try. Yep, it is. Okay, Xbox, I am not playing you again for the rest of the year.
How's the Steam Deck performance, by the way? I see like a lot of articles about it.
Well,
lucky for you, one of our newest contributors on the site, Mikhail, wrote about the Steam Deck performance on Metaphor for pretty extensively.
Yeah, Mikhail. A bunch of us here have known him for a bit. He's based out of India. He was previously at Touch Arcade, and so if you've already seen our Metaphor article, you'll probably have noticed, hey, that style of thumbnail seems familiar. That's because he was the coffee guy, the coffee Steam Deck guy over at Touch Arcade, where he always had the like cup of coffee or something and then showing like what he'd been checking out and whatnot.
Mikhail's a great dude. Yeah, like you said, we've known him for quite a while, and just having him help out with us, joining us on the staff, a huge help, you know, especially because, you know, he's really good at, like, just testing out things on the Steam Deck, because he has both models and, like, is able to, like, write very extensive things that it seems like it helped out a lot of people, because a lot of people were kind of iffy on Metaphor's Steam Deck performance because of the demo, and then the demo got patched, and then the full game, even for the review codes, got patched. So it's like, okay, what is the state of this game on Steam Deck? And Mikhail chronicled all of that pretty well. So definitely give that a read if you're interested in playing Metaphor on Steam Deck. Seems to be, you know, he has like the recommended settings and tested it extensively of like what performance you could expect under certain loads on Steam Deck.
Yep.
So yeah, give the review a look on the website, rptsite.net. We've got Mikhail's kind of Steam Deck Steam Deck guide. So it's basically a guide. Guided impressions. And then, of course, we have the more walkthrough-like guides on the site as well for Metaphor. And I know like people like Chao, myself, and I presume Adam are going to be struggling Metaphor in with the rest of the games as we head towards the end of the year. So So I like I said, I converted my demo save to a full save on Metaphor, but I haven't started it yet because there are a few other like game updates that I had circled that I wanted to play and kind of quote like knock out before I got there. So I'm not going to talk about either of these too much at length, and I'll go into the details why when I go into it. But at the end of September and early October, I've played through the Starfield Shattered Space like DLC episode, and I've played through Diablo 4 Vessel of Hatred. So I'm going to kind of, I'll talk about Diablo first, I suppose, and then in Starfield. But this, when I was thinking going into the podcast today, thinking like, what am I going to talk about? Because there's, I'll be honest, it's difficult to think of something like really enlightening to say, because obviously we talked about these games as they released last year. And the I don't want to say something kind of as inane as, well, it's more Diablo 4 or it's more Starfield. So just, you know, it's more of the same. But I also kind of want to give them their due and talk about them to at least some extent. So I figured I'd at least do my best here and kind of at least get them a look in, because they did release. And I do know that there are, you know, are people that have played these games since the release late last year. And we're looking forward to these updates. Unfortunately, I was not one of those. I last played both of these games, like at best early this year, like in January, February timeframe, but I have not kind of kept up to date. So for both of these, it was kind of a two-step of knocking the rust off and then seeing the new content. Like, what was I doing again? How do I play this game again? I did see both games to credits, but I didn't really like 100% either game. So starting with Diablo, Vessel of Hatred released earlier in October. And it adds it basically follows off on the cliffhanger of the story of the base game. It adds a new region to the game. It adds obviously a new class, the Spiritborn. And then of course it adds some new like gearing type systems and progression in that sense. For me though, it was a little bit difficult to kind of parse it for two reasons. And this is a little bit of a shameful admission, I guess, but when I beat Diablo 4 last year, I never got to like max level. So none of the end game stuff, like the Paragon system, I had to interface with before. So I got to max level. That was kind of new to me, but it's not new to the game. And then in addition to that, the game has had multiple seasons like since the release last year that have kind of overhauled some of the progression systems as well. I think one of them was called like Season of Loot Reborn. They changed the upgrade system so that now it's called Masterworking. And I'm not going to go into every single minutia about how gearing works in Diablo 4 because we kind of covered it last year and it's a little bit in the weeds. But you can like enchant specific affixes to change them. You can temper based on the type of gear that you have. You can slot, of course, gems. That's pretty classic Diablo. You can imprint on legendary items, which is kind of like a unique buff that's only for legendary tier and above. And the specific mechanics about how those worked had kind of changed and shifted over the seasons. So I kind of had to relearn some of that. But the new region is like the base game of Diablo 4 is effectively divided into five regions of the continent. And as expected, Vessel of Hatred adds a sixth region. It's called the Nahantu region. It's like a foresty region to the south. And that's kind of where the new act takes place. And it's pretty much wholly contained there. You don't really revisit any old areas. In general, I kind of like when game expansions, whether it's a Fallout expansion or anything, to not only be self-contained to the new region, because that just makes it feel like really cut off from everything else. But unfortunately, that's kind of what it is for both Diablo and Starfield, is that the new content, at least as far as I can tell in most major ways, is just kind of walled off and into this new area only.
So that's different than, for example, like Phantom Liberty, would you say?
Phantom Liberty,
I know Phantom Liberty has like a new region, but it has, I haven't played it, it has some ties to like, it has a new ending, right?
It has more ties to the base game. If this is a little bit of an older one, but the Fallout 3 update, the one that added the better ending, I'm trying to find the different Fallout 3 Operation Anchorage. You know, I think it was Broken Steel, but like those ones were a little bit more integrated in the main game, where you'd go to familiar places. I guess it kind of depends on the player. Like to me, it's fun to see new assets, new regions, but I also kind of want to revisit old places, and because it feels less manufactured that way. It's like, oh, everything past that fence is new. Everything prior to that fence is old. It just feels very like delineated in that way. But that's kind of how it feels like in Diablo 4 for the most case. Phantom Liberty did have a few side quests that had you like you'd either meet a character outside of the new area, I think it was called Dogtown, and then you'd go there and you'd see them again, or you would have a side quest that had you return to older locations, only just with new events happening. And I think that just feels a lot more naturally integrated, but probably a little bit more difficult to integrate. My main takeaway, once I did a little bit of just reminding myself, like, okay, what was added in season 4? Okay, what was already at base game, but it is new to me, but not new to the game? Once I kind of pulled away what was new to Vessel of Hatred, I guess I was a little bit whelmed, so to speak. Like, oh, that's only new to me because I didn't get to max level. Oh, that's only new to me because I didn't play the Loot Reborn season. Once I pull away like what's actually added in Vessel of Hatred, there's a new class. And I didn't roll a new character. I just used my existing character. So you obviously are introduced to some NPCs that are Spiritborn, and you get some of the flavor of it. But I have not played the class, so I cannot speak to that in a direct sense. You do get them new mercenaries. The mercenaries are fine, but they're kind of limited. You basically meet 4 NPCs. I think we talked about them when they were detailed in the news post. You do a kind of a short to medium quest to like recruit them. And then you can pick one to follow you all the time, and then you can pick one to like jump in and assist you. They can be like proc'd based on a type of ability that you do. They just come in, do their ability, and then they leave. And it's kind of outside of that, you kind of tear up their reputation with you, your rapport. And then they what they unlock is as you tear up these mercenaries, they do get a small passive bonuses, but they're pretty inconsequential as far as I can tell. I don't usually notice that they're there. Maybe it's more prevalent on harder difficulties or something. And you get a unique currency to be able to spend at a shop to buy legendary gear. And it's kind of like, okay, that's fine, but it's nothing like woo super exciting. But maybe I haven't interfaced with it much, but you get unique currency as you level up these mercenaries, and then you take it back to base, so to speak, and then you can trade for new items.
Do they feel useful from like the moment-to-moment combat?
The first one that you get that's a story related, his name is Rahir. All the other, like, there's 4 of them. One of them is directly integrated to the story, kind of. That's Rahir. And then the other 3 are you don't even have to get them. They're optional. And they have a little independent story, but that's fine. But Rahir has some abilities that he can like pull some aggro, which is useful sometimes, but usually there's the way that Diablo is balanced. It's a large number of enemies that die very quickly. So having a character try to pull aggro, at least on the difficulty I'm playing at, maybe it's something that really shines if you're like on tier 4 or something and I'm on tier 2. But to me, I don't really notice that they're there. Every once in a while, they'll chime in on the story, but it's like, it's very kind of like superfluous stuff that, you know, they might as well not be there, which makes sense. Cause if you could have one of any 4 there, they just chime in and say like, that looks suspicious. And, you know, something that's just kind of like a throwaway line. They're kind of fun enough, to tear up and like try out, but they don't really integrate. They're fine. I'll keep it as that. Mm-hmm. And then for the story itself, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it was the sort of thing. And I hate it when this happens. You ever play a game and you fight a boss and you're like, all right, now I'm ready for the real final boss. And then the game's over. You're like, oh, wait, I guess that was it. That's what this game was.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I remember my friend talking about that. It's like there's like some sort of like, I won't say what sort of animal, but there's like a thing that like it's definitely building up to. And it's like, oh, that's it. Okay. Oh.
Yeah, I really legitimately thought like, all right, that was the penultimate boss. Now shit's going to go down. Things are going to escalate and we're going to... That's it. What? Okay. And like, yeah. And the thing is that then I try to like sit back. I'm like, was I misled, or like, did I just kind of not parse it properly? Like, I try to blame myself, but I'm like, no, that really, I feel whelmed.
That's for the next expansion.
Yeah. And the story, speaking at a high level, and this is just premise stuff, not spoiler stuff. And first of all, it only takes like 6 hours to play through. More if you do the side quests and things like that. But you follow the character Nayrel, who has Mephisto's stone. That's all at the end of the base game. And the trailer that they released for Vessel of Hatred, and which is one of the opening cinematics, is that you can see it's slowly corrupting her. Like, basically, the premise is that you want to save her and stop Mephisto. The thing is that a lot of the flavor, now it's been a long time since I played Diablo 3, but I felt like I was getting a little bit of that, like, wait a minute, like, Diablo 3, it's not the exact same situation, but you're dealing with the character Leah, who is, like, becoming, like, a host of Diablo, and it's, like, the similar sort of, like, girl trying to fight off the demon inside. Like, I just feel like it was a little bit like been there before in a mm-hmm. sense, even though the parameters are slightly different, the flavor was pretty similar. And then you are kind of incentivized, just as you are in the base game, to do some side quests, because as you do side quests in a region, you get renown, and with extra renown, you get an extra potion slot, you get an extra skill point, like beyond reaching max level. So I did a little bit of like running around, and there were actually a few side quests that kind of chained together in pretty interesting ways. They weren't a highlight, but they were fine. I will say one highlight, to say something that I actually really did like about Vessel of Hatred, is that I've really enjoyed just some of the composing, some of the music tracks. A lot of them sounded like, there's like four or five composers credited on Vessel of Hatred, so I'm not sure who to credit here. But there are some backing tracks that reminded me of the work done in like the Divinity series from like Borisov Slavov. And like that is just, I really enjoyed some of that. I actually like traveled. Some of the older regions are connected to the newer region directly, so you can go between them. And actually, I went to the older region and it changed the music to something that wasn't as good. I'm like, oh, that actually is something that the expansion has going for it. It actually is pretty good music. I haven't dabbled too much in the new endgame stuff. There's like there's like a new Undercity where you go through and there's like different floors and you have a limited amount of time going into each floor. And as you like explore, you can do little sub objectives, either give yourself more time or give yourself a higher like bonus at the end. The idea is that you run through it several times, you know, that's not a surprise with this sort of game. So I've done the introduction to that. Like, you have a little quest that introduces you to the end game, but I haven't really like done it enough to really grasp it in terms of like, oh, this is how you progress, like this is what I'm tearing up at this point. But that is introduced to you pretty early on. And then you have the option to either complete the story or go back to it. And I decided to complete the story instead.
Did you try out the new class? Like, they added a Spiritborn class,
I think. Yeah, right? I didn't. I just went with my older character. So that's one thing that I just, unfortunately, just can't really speak to.
Yeah.
The story at least does introduce you to a couple of NPCs that are Spiritborn and a couple of the concepts behind it. So at least it gives you like the context. And it's one of those things that isn't necessary, but I do appreciate. It's like, by the way, we're also adding the class, and it feels divorced from the story. It's like, no, it makes sense why they're adding it. It is like related to the goings on of the expansion. So yeah,
all I know about Spiritborn is my friends call it Green Monk, and apparently it's very busted, as in like it's
I have heard that it's busted, but yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, that's kind of my time with Vessel of Hatred. And like I said, it's hard to say anything too enlightening about it, but it gave me an opportunity to revisit Diablo 4 and kind of see a little bit more of the endgame stuff. Like, I actually see like the Paragon Tree system. And then like, there's some stuff that I think has been adjusted from that, like the way that glyphs slot into it. So you can kind of see the different ways that they add kind of horizontal progression. Like, you might have your slotted gear in a good spot, but maybe the glyphs in your Paragon Tree aren't the best. So figure out a good way to farm those and slot those in, you know, that way you can really like tier up to higher levels. But I just haven't put enough time in. I think my overall total Diablo 4 playtime is something like 40 hours total. Like, I've not been swimming in this. It's something where I played the story. I did like each of the end game ideas once. I did a few nightmare dungeons. I did one run of the Undercity. So I'm kind of just like getting my taste, but then I kind of move on to the next thing. But it's more Diablo 4. There you go.
Yeah, I bought that initial $60 purchase, and I went through the main campaign and very little of the end game. The first person, I was like, I think I'm done. I don't want to make more Diablo 4.
Yeah,
I'm good.
Just the DLC, it kind of ends on a cliffhanger again. I don't know if it's going to be like a second DLC, which I think would be pretty novel for Diablo. Usually, kind of gets the one major update and that's it, or if it's for a future project of some sort.
Diablo 5.
Yeah. Yeah, but the thing is, like, I would have been okay with them, like, I don't think cliffhangers or even, like, not even cliffhangers, just having an open ending, I don't think it's necessarily bad. It's just that when you had that coupled with the, oh, that was it, sort of, like, unexpected abruptness of, oh, you get the little challenge complete. You completed the campaign. I'm like, I did? Like, that's a pretty good sign.
Yeah, we're still waiting for our fucking Forspoken 2, based on the way that the Forspoken DLC ended, okay? We're gonna be waiting forever.
There you go. And then the other thing that I played earlier this month was the Starfield Shattered Space DLC. And this one was really kind of more marketed as just like an extra DLC. Like, I think they call it DLC 1. So I wasn't expecting this to be like a full, you know, expansion. The lines between those two, of course, are pretty blurry. But Starfield Shattered Space is even more of just kind of like an isolated node attached to the rest of the main game. So I played through the story of Starfield, kind of Critical Path did last year. I did a few of like optional, like mainline optional side factions, but I didn't really like, I put in like 30 hours and that was it. So I go back into Starfield, similar to Diablo 4. A lot of it was just kind of me like relearning it, kind of. I was actually on New Game Plus, so I had all the new New Game Plus. The way that New Game Plus works in Starfield is pretty unique and actually kind of a highlight of the game. But it did also mean that I had to like get back to where I was, like story-wise, be able to go anywhere. But once I did, it kind of introduces itself almost like if you had to guess, Adam, how a DLC is added to a game like Starfield, I'm sure you could guess pretty closely. Do you want to guess or do you want me to just go into it?
There's a new planet.
Basically.
Or a so new you, galaxy with new places to land on.
I believe it's as soon as you try to like do a jump from your starting planet to any other planet, you come across like a derelict space station. And it's like once you interact with that, that kicks you off on the DLC. So it's almost one of those things where it's like you could have guessed that, but also like I don't want to blame it too much because how else are they going to do it? So you go to this space station. It's called the Oracle. And inside of it, you find these like things that are almost like ghosts. They're like humanoid, like blue ghosts. I was trying to think of another word for ghosts. I was going to call them ghosts. And it kind of feels like they're not dead, but they're phantoms. Not in the same. Phantoms. That's a good way to put it. And the word that they call is vortex. And vortex is basically a term that is, once you learn about the goings on, is described as like the space between universes. And that's one of Starfield's like core conceits, is that there's multiple parallel universes with slight like aberrations in each one, and the vortex is like the space between them. So it's very like high level concept. And the idea is that in the base Starfield game, you hear about this this cult that worships kind of like this snake god, and you kind of see them here and there. They're called the Cult of Varun. You kind of see them here and there, but you don't really get to like see like the genesis of it. And that was it was kind of like an open-ended mystery. And even back when the game first launched, you thought that's where the DLC is going to go, and that's where it did go. But the way that it manifests, it almost feels like it could have been anything. So you go to the space station, you end up like rebooting it, and then it kind of re-engages its hyperdrive, and it then teleports you like through light space to. I forget the name of the planet, but it's where the cult of the House of Varun is located. It's a moon of a new system. And once you beat the DLC, it's just a system you can just travel to. It's just like another node on the map. You go there and you basically learn that there's been some sort of cataclysm and the vortex is basically seeping out. There's a lot of these phantoms, these vortex creatures, and the current prophet, what they call the speaker, is missing. And they think that he either caused it deliberately or accidentally, and you're not sure why. But other than that, then it kind of becomes very like rote, in so to speak. There's end up like, this is going to almost sound like you've been there before. There's three different houses within the cult that are vying for power, and you end up being introduced to each one in turn, and you help each one out. You kind of learn how each one thinks, but then you have to kind of bring them together in order to like solve the crisis at hand. So it feels like very like organized in that sense. Pro forma, I think, is a term that Adam likes to use. Like, of course, you're going to help. You don't have the option to pick one or the other. You help all three, and then you bring them together, and then you solve the event. And then I thought, like, well, maybe at the end of all of it, this DLC also took like 5 hours, something like that. But I was pretty thorough with this. Like, I explored like all the different locations on this new planet and things like that. Did all the side quests. And I thought, well, maybe there's going to be like a major choice that you make at the end that kind of tells you like how this is going to interface with the main game. But as far as I can tell, and after doing some Googling, it's like given a false choice. Basically, what you learn is that the speaker of this cult wants to re-engage in a war with what is called the settled systems, the rest of the game map. And it seems like as far as I can tell, I did not play through the game multiple times, so I did not see like the different outcomes for myself. But the outcome that I got, and as far as I can tell, the outcome that you always get is that you stop that. You basically prevent war from breaking out, which kind of makes sense because otherwise, how like those are two different great scopes of two different like scopes of how the DLC could interface with the main game. If all of a sudden you're gonna have a lot more like cultists in like the rest of the game map, I'm not sure. Apparently, there is a choice at the end where you can choose whether this new planet remains hostile or friendly to you. But that's just kind of the same as like if you go to any planet in the game and you get a bounty on your head, they're gonna start. They start shooting at you until you clear the bounty, which you can do like through the kiosks in game. But it really kind of feels more just like a like an extended planet excursion rather than like anything more substantial than that. I mean, it's fun enough, but like in terms of like what does it add to the main game, you can craft like some new vortex gear. Like you can craft things called vortex grenades. Like some of them are like you throw a grenade and it like pulls enemies to it. So it kind of like groups them up in that way, which is kind of fun, but it's like, I don't know if that's like a highlight. And like I had to remind myself, of course, I started playing with that new buggy. I forget what it's called, like the Verve 8 or something. It's the Mako, but that's not DLC. It's not DLC exclusive. That's just in the game now. And like I actually really enjoy that a lot. I almost feel like it's almost like one of those things where it's like I feel like it should be DLC just to kind of give the DLC more meat to it. But it's not. It's a free update, which I also can't like complain about. Everyone gets it. Because you do, like, I put a few trait points into, like, being able to scan from afar and have high oxygen so that I could, like, run and scan planets pretty efficiently. But it does make it a lot more convenient to have the buggy that you can do all that from. Because you can scan from the buggy, and that way if you're doing, like, the planet, I forget what it's called, like, the planet scanning feature, it's a little bit less of a side quest. But other than that, it was like one of those things where it felt like, all right, you finish your excursion, back to the rest of the game. It didn't really just interface in that way. It kind of felt like it was stapled on in that sense. Some of the characters you meet are fine. Some of the it does climax in a pretty fun way on the crashed ship on the new planet that the vortex is like seeping out of. But other than that, it kind of does feel like inconsequential once you're done with it. Like it feels like it didn't really matter. It could have been any other side quest. So it's one of those things where I'm not down on it, but it just doesn't like elevate it. It doesn't boost Starfield's in my mind.
Remind me, was this something you had to pay for, the Shatter Spades DLC?
Yes.
Okay. Because yeah, I remember that people, I guess, were caught off guard by like how short it was. Obviously, people had different expectations. So some like you like maybe already expected it to be on the shorter side, but I think a lot of people were caught off guard just like how quickly it goes by.
Yeah, it's not very long, and it feels like it could just be a side quest on any planet, really. Like, if you had bought, like, a gold edition of the game early on, like, let's say in 6 years you bought a gold edition of the game that all the DLC included, but you weren't sure what was DLC, there's nothing really here that tells you, this was added content. And I'm not sure, I had to think of myself, like, what do I mean by that? Like, does every added content have to, like, change the game or, like, shake it up? And part of me is kind of like, well, maybe yes. Because you are asking for additional money for it. But what would that have to look like? So I kind of had like a more like esoteric, like, what would I had rather seen? And again, it kind of goes back to the thing with like Diablo 4. Like, I wish it just touched more on like core game things. Like, now that the way you build ships is different, or we've changed, like, now you have a new trait tree that you can use anywhere. But like, no, all the same traits are there, all the same crafting is there. This is mostly a narrative expansion with a few things like I guess like the vortex like consumables that you can do, but it feels just kind of inconsequential in that way. So it's one of those things where it really is more of the same with Starfield, which if Starfield was received and was, you know, was on a good footing going in, would have been fine. But it's one of those things where it's like it's more of the same when Starfield needed more, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I left off. I guess I'm kind of on both of these games, so to speak. But that's just my personal impression. As far as I can tell for like Starfield, and this is me assuming intent from like Steam reviews and things like that, but like it feels like people who are more invested in Starfield might be more disappointed in the DLC because they wanted it and kind of needed it to be more. For me, I'm like returning after not playing it for 9 months. So a lot of it's like, yeah, that's the Starfield I remember. It's not really more or less than that. But yeah, I put some time into those. I did want to experience them firsthand and kind of form my own opinion on those. But luckily, they're kind of both brief enough that if you are just kind of curious, there or to play academically, I guess we use that terminology sometimes. they're not too onerous to play through and kind of see for yourself, which is kind of like the lowest lukewarm praise I can get, but it is kind of where I'm sitting after playing both of them. But yeah, that's the two games that I had played before basically queuing those out of the way to make space for Metaphor, which is what I'm going to be, you know, diving into probably as soon as this podcast ends. And with that, I think we'll go into the news section of this, unless we had any other follow-ups for games we've been playing this week.
Nope. I've been, after Metaphor, I started just, I kind of like in this weird kind of space from,
I don't know how I've been doing it, going right from Metaphor into fucking Trails games. It's like,
maybe Daybreak or Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. I'm just like, what am I doing with my life after you?
Yeah, like, I kind of in that weird space, like, what am I doing? Like, I kind of been starting to visit the mana a little. I'm like, I don't know. Then now I'm just having a fun time with Goku and Sparking Zero.
Yeah,
that's what I've been doing.
You know what I'm looking forward to in the next couple weeks? That new Mario Party, which looks really good, and the Sonic X Shadow Generations.
I wonder if I could get Sonic X Shadow Generations. I don't know. I wasn't planning on getting Sparking Zero, yet somehow I just ended up getting Sparking Zero, and I don't know why. So I don't know if I'm going to get... It just might be that situation again where I just somehow just like find myself like, oh, maybe I should go play that new Sonic game. It kind of looks kind of rad. Well, I mean, it's a re-release, but also it seems to be good with the new Shadow stuff. I don't know.
I have a random tangent.
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday I was with my girlfriend, and her cousin was in town, and we went to like one of those places that you can walk in and pick a piece of like pottery and like paint it up and have it fired. So I grabbed a little, you know, cute little hedgehog, and I was dumb and I painted it like Sonic. I gave him the green eyes and the red boots or whatever. And then the person was like, well, we had someone come do a Sonic last week. You had to do a Shadow. I'm like, oh, I misunderstood the assignment. No. but I don't know. It feels like that franchise is not one I've played since like Sonic Colors. Is it in a really good spot right now with like the movie hype and the game hype for it, which is weird considering where it was even like 4 or 5 years ago.
It's kind of weird like just thinking about like, oh, that new re-release of Sonic Generations will have a Shadow, like it has the Shadow stuff, but then it also have like a separate Shadow DLC that has the movie Shadow voiced by Keanu Reeves as part of it too.
Yeah,
which is kind of fucking crazy to think about.
Yeah.
So going into the news of this week, not a lot here, but we have a few interesting game announcements. So this one is actually from Square Enix. It is a strategy RPG for mobile games called Ember Storia. It's a free-to-play strategy RPG for iOS and Android and PC in Japan. They announced, I don't know if they announced that this is planning for a worldwide release.
Did you mention that this is a Square Enix game?
Yeah, I think he did Retro Square Enix.
Yeah, yes. He did.
Okay. Yeah, but they haven't made no mention whether it's going to get a worldwide.
Because with like the mobile stuff, it seems like it's always like separate. But I'm not in that space. Maybe I'm just not quite informed about how those games release.
Yeah, but this is like kind of a weird one because like at first glance, if you just like took away the Square Enix branding and you just looked at this trailer in like just by itself, you would think it looks like a new Fire Emblem game.
Yeah, it has the same character designer.
Yeah, it has character designer Yusuke Kozaki, yeah, who's most known for Awakening and Fates, on the project. Then they also have music from Masashi Hamauzu, who's worked on FF13 and Saga Frontier 2. And you also have Benny Matsuyama from Imperial Saga, which is like a browser saga game.
Maybe this is the Deal Field sequel that you always wanted.
It's kind of a weird one, right? Because like you look at it, it's like a strategy RPG, but then you look at the small amount of gameplay, it looks like it's like an RTS style game. It's I don't know, man. I mean, obviously, it's you have to temper expectations because it's a mobile game, so it definitely has that, like, you know, since it has like sort of like a city building or town building aspect to it, designed for a mobile platform. So obviously, there's gonna be some element of like over time when you're not playing the game, it'll accrue resources. When you're not playing the game, and then you're building facilities to get more resources when you're like passively, so forth. So it's like it's one of those like hard sells that's like, I don't really like those kinds of games already, but it kind of nice. It has a nice art style, but there's also not an English version. So it's like, I don't know. I mean, it's I was
It's also a Square Enix mobile game. You know those also... little ass.
Yeah. This will either be up for like at max a year, or maybe it'll go surprisingly more than 2 years. Who knows?
And the first half of this trailer is all CG cutscenes, which does look straight out of like Fire Emblem. But yeah, when it goes and looks, shows you that like isometric, like town building RTS aspect to it, I can almost imagine like pausing it and putting like the really bubbly UI and like a stamina meter in the upper right. Like I can almost see it, and I'm already like, ugh. But
yeah.
I actually remember when Square Enix trademarked the term Ember Storia like 2 years ago. And I remember people at the time wondering, like, what is this? Maybe it's the subtitle for the new Final Fantasy Tactics remake, which will come any day now.
Little did they know. So the next two headlines here, I actually had to ask Adam a little bit because I was a little bit confused on this. Because I saw both of these headlines come up in the news this week, and I had to make sure I wasn't reading the same thing twice. But these are two games that are both at least being initially covered as spiritual successors to Disco Elysium, or at least games built by former Disco Elysium developers. Disco Elysium, of course, built by Zom, and then had a giant falling out with the original writers and those that hold the IP, and I think a few governments were involved. It was a very shaky situation, and kind of a shame for a game that really was kind of like a flash in the pan and really kind of critically and commercially acclaimed in a lot of different ways, and in a way that we hadn't seen, like that people have been trying to follow and try to chase after that idea of a game that's sort of like City Street RPG that Disco Elysium was able to capture so well. So I'm just going to kind of cover these two games in no particular order. But Dark Math Games has announced a new detective RPG called XXX Night Shift. And this game does actually have an introductory trailer. They call it a dialogue gameplay trailer. And you can just see as soon as you watch this trailer, the Disco kind of lineage. It's got like the UI where the text is on the right side of the screen and the gameplay is on the left side of the screen with kind of the UI elements to the left of that. And they call this a detective role-playing RPG with seismic choices. Crime investigation, find a partner or fly solo, and things like that. But it has kind of like a fun noir vibe and kind of like a muted art style. Again, this will launch for PC at some point, but is very early in development. It looks like Night Shift Games was founded actually last year. Currently has a team of 20 developers, about half of which worked on Disco Elysium. So it's kind of a small indie project for those that were able to, you know, find a new landing ground after all that went down with Zom. And then here's the second one. We have a founding of a new studio by Disco Elysium developers. They've founded a studio called Longdo. Also has veterans from Bungie, Rockstar, and Brave at Night. And they've announced that they're making seeking funding to develop a psychogeographic RPG with narrative depth that will continue the legacy of Disco Elysium. So we got kind of concept art here, but no title, but just announced kind of in the same week as the other title, as XXX Night Shift. So just interesting to see that former Disco Elysium developers have found two different landing grounds that are both trying to preserve that idea of game and kind of find where that game succeeded and build upon that. Yeah, both of these games seem like they're kind of helmed by small crews and they're a little bit further out. But it's just kind of, we report on it here because obviously it's just kind of motivating to see some of that creative talent behind Zom is, you know, they're still working on, you know, things that they're passionate about. And obviously Disco Elysium kind of resonated with a lot of people for a lot of different ways and was really unique in that space. So obviously we'll kind of keep our tabs on anything that those former developers are working on and see how it turns out. And this is one that I wasn't really aware of until I started seeing it come up in our Discord channel a little bit. But free-to-play MMORPG Brighter Shores is launching in early access on November 6th. And I really didn't know anything about this, but I think they were kind of promoting having some sort of private beta access if you subscribe to like their website or something like that. And we got some new screenshots for the upcoming early access for it. It's kind of got an interesting, kind of charming, quaint look to it. not really high fidelity, but kind of like I'm almost nostalgic for like those that played things like RuneScape back in the day. But otherwise, I don't know if Adam, if you had more ideas or insight on this game.
All I know is that this is from the RuneScape developer, and this is basically his follow-up.
Yeah, well, that explains why I have that kind of feeling when I look at the screenshots here.
Yeah,
but yeah, coming into early access later this year. So you know, MMORPGs. That one NCSoft one just came out. I'm blanking on the name.
Throne in Liberty.
Yeah, that's it. And I had heard, you know, people were like, this game's character creator is amazing, but all the characters are boring and the story stinks. And oh, that's secondhand. I've not played it myself, but it just seems like the MMO market is just hard to break into because there's so many like legacy MMO or service type games that you have to kind of pull players away from in order to get them invested into yours. So I think Brighter Shores, if it is kind of more of a smaller scope thing, might actually have more success there rather than trying to outpace, you know, things like WoW and Final Fantasy. But it does really seem like this is kind of going for something a little bit more cozy than that.
Yeah, I remember the good old days of RuneScape web, but it was like still very, very early web-based browser. You could run it off a browser, mm-hmm. and you had the open PvP zones. It was before even having a segmented PvP zone. It was just PvP anywhere, and then it was still free to play. And to access like the premium version areas, you had like literal like gates and fences. I'd like guards like say, hey, do you basically have the premium version? You can pass through them. If not, fuck you. Stay in your free zone, idiot. You're not allowed in this area. The good old days, so to speak. You know?
And they say the interesting thing here is that this game is to be designed to be fun, no matter how much free time the players spend on it, without microtransactions. But it is free to play. So if it's free to play and without microtransactions, I'm like, well, then... ads, I suppose. Okay,
probably. Yeah,
we'll see. I think we had one person on staff that was interested in at least trying out like the private. I don't know if it's a stress test or a beta or premium access or some sort, but if we are able to see that, it'd be interesting to have them report on it. We have a new version of Honkai Star Rail releasing on October 23rd. I'm going to have to rely on Chow to tell me what's important about this.
It's basically a dead patch, sort of.
It's a dead patch. Got it.
So every time in like Genshin or Honkai, you know, when it gets to like version like 1.5 or 1.6-ish, it's like the dead drought patches. It's like... Oh,
I didn't say this is version 2.6. I don't know if I said the actual version number, but yeah.
Yeah, those are like kind of the dead patches. So it's just basically a new character, just... enter event, and that's basically it, right? There's not much to say to it. I do enjoy the last event, like the main storyline, because they updated the main storyline in the previous event, and it's a pretty good event in my opinion. So, but yeah, it's a dead patch, just getting new characters. I think the biggest thing that people care about is that it announced a character that is supposed to be dead is not dead, and now you could roll for the actual version of that character. Everyone will know who I'm talking about. You see her neck get snapped in one of the earlier patches, and now you find out that she's not dead.
Huh.
So, that's basically it in a nutshell.
So there's a dead patch with a returning dead character. It seems in theme.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, like, I don't know, most people just think it's like, oh, she's too important to be killed off, so... early, I guess. That's what most people kind of thought with that patch back in the day. Like, for people that play it, they know who it is. They make a lot of memes of her. It's like, oh, I got my waifu back, but her neck is snapped or some shit like that. Or when they bought the toy, like, they have a figure of her and a ship with the broken neck. You're like, dang. More accurate.
Holy crazy.
But, yeah, that's basically the patch in a nutshell. I think I'm most hyped for 2.8. That's like two patches away because we get the real Herta. What is it, Josh? Do you remember Herta?
She was like a little bit. She's like the doll character.
Yeah. You know how you never get to see the real her?
Yeah.
Well, apparently the game kind of like gives you like a silhouette of like the real her, which is like a witch.
I have to reinstall. Am I right?
That's kind of like what I'm saving for. I don't really care about Rafa. It's like she looks cool, But I don't really care for like the type of character that she play as. She's like I don't even know how to say it. Erudiction. I don't know how the hell you say it. It's like they're focused on AoEs and they're like the lamest like role in the game. They basically had to like make one mode so that people feel like justified getting those kind of characters. That's basically what I feel about them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. I don't really care about this patch too much. I'm more hyped like two patches away. So that's for me.
We got another kind of newsletter update for the upcoming Dragon Quest III HD 2D remake. So, of course, releasing in mid-November. We talked about previously about how this remake is going to introduce the new Monster Wrangler vocation. Do I have that right? Monster Wrangler?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Monster Wrangler. And then this update kind of tethers into that a little bit. It talks about different Monster Arena tournaments that are exclusive to the new remake, where each one you basically can... I believe recruit new monsters to your group based on the tournaments tie into the Monster Wrangler vocation here. I'm trying to parse the pressure.
I previewed this feature at PAX West and I met hands on the Monster Arena, and you're basically rescuing monsters for like a more expanded arena feature in the Dragon Quest III HD 2D remake. So you can like form parties of like three monsters and like have and like battle them inside the tournament or the arena and like give them commands, like not direct commands, but like, you know, like just basic, like, hey, like go all out or conserve your MP or stuff like that. And then you'll get rewarded based on like, you know, being able to advance through the ranks in the Monster Arena tournaments, basically.
And then, of course, they revealed just like a handful, like 15 new screenshots of the game. And they obviously are keying in on the HD 2D art style. I'm looking at it. I'm just like, I just hope the blur can be turned off because it has that depth of field effect, I think, too strongly. Well, but
since as a PC version, it's looking hopefully likely at the very least. If it's not there as an option, I'm sure the PC community will be like, we're going to make sure it's an option.
We already mentioned this early on, but Metaphor Re Fantasio is our sales update this week. It has already sold 1 million units. And not a lot of release dates, only one that I have listed here. The spin-off game from Lost Eidolons called Lost Eidolons Veil of the Witch. This is something that Scott was able to actually preview back, I think, at PAX East earlier this year, is going to release in Steam Early Access on November 5th.
I think that's... Yeah, I'm like thinking of, like, was there any other news pieces? I think that was it this week. It was a pretty... thankfully, a pretty light week, all things considering, because of the Metaphor coming out and everything.
Yeah. But yeah, one other thing that I did not shout out earlier in the podcast, but I'll make sure to shout out here, is that we do have two other opinion pieces up on the site. We did have Paul review Anatria, the last song, which finally did release in September. And then we had Quentin give a preview for the upcoming Mario and Luigi Brothership, which is slated to release in early November. So we have both of those up on the site as well.
All right.
And of course, the go ahead.
Go for it.
I was going to say, well, also the Metaphor review and guides and Steam Deck feature and all that stuff.
Yeah.
We need a show of hands. Who's getting a Nintendo Alarmo this coming January? Spend $100 for a Nintendo alarm clock.
The clock in my home office does need to be replaced. So maybe.
Maybe. It's time. Have Mario say bing bing wahoo yahoo. Get up, Brian. You lazy sack of shit.
That's what Mario says. I don't follow like the Nintendo like insiders or anything like that, but I wonder how many people are like, Nintendo's gonna be releasing new hardware announcement in October. And then it was this.
I think the whole concept is very funny. It's just like,
well, remember when they did like that? This is just what Nintendo does. They did that like cardboard initiative.
Yeah, Labo.
Yeah, and that just kind of like came and went within a year. And it's just like, I don't know if it succeeded or failed or did exactly what it was supposed to, but when I see something like that from like Nintendo, I'm like, oh, okay. That's just what they do.
Would you be more enticed if they added Xenoblade alarms to it?
Maybe.
I love the video of someone edited the trailer that had the Xenoblade 2 battle effects of like all the enemies screaming at you while you're characters are screaming and yelling their names, so just like a fucking cacophony of noises as your alarm clock for a Xenoblade 2 battle. It's like, fuck, I would probably get annoyed and get up. You got me.
Now I'm imagining like the Monado on its side and the middle dial is the clock face. And when it alarms, it like, I don't know, turns blue. I would buy that. Now that I've thought about it in my mind, I would totally buy it.
You're like, you know what?
If it existed, which
it's a $100 idea. And when you think back of like a phone, cell phones like a decade ago already having this feature of like having custom ringtones as your alarm clock, as your alarm tune. But you know what? It's not Nintendo.
But yeah, that covers us for this episode of the Tetracast. Of course, everyone listening, we all hope you're enjoying playing through Metaphor or whatever fall release you're currently playing or excited to play. If you have liked this podcast, please give us a like, give us a rating, give us a comment. We'd like to see those. You can find RPG Site on most of the social media networks. Just search for RPG space Site, S-I-T-E, and you should be able to find us. Do join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite. We have a lot of people that are interested in playing Metaphor right now. And of course, you know, we have the guides up on the site, and we're going to continue to kind of work through those, workshop those, and try to find out what people are searching for. And as you know, we have people on staff that are also going to be starting and playing through the game as well. So we're going to try to make sure that those are in as useful of a place as possible before we get into everything else releasing later in the month. So we've got, I think in the next couple of weeks, we've got Romancing Saga and Ys, and we'll see what we have on deck for after that point. But until you hear from us next time, stay safe. Take care, and we'll talk to y'all later.
Alarma.